In 1968, Helen McCloslin was angry. Like many liberals of her generation, she had every right to be angry. Remember that 1968 is the height of the Vietnam War. In that year, civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Also, Democratic presidential hopeful Robert Kennedy was also killed. Historians often characterize the 1960s as the decade of discontent. And so for Helen McCloslin to vent her frustrations, she did two things. First, she placed a neon pink-colored peace sign above her fireplace. And this anti-war symbol, framed by tall glass windows, as you see up there, and a steep angular ceiling, she placed it above the hearth in solidarity with the Vietnam protesters who carried similar emblems with them in the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. At the age of 70-odd years, her means of dissent were less about feet on the street and more about paint on the canvas. And so McCloslin retreated to the studio room of her newly constructed home, located here in Bozeman, Montana, and generated a whole series of collages on which she could vent her anger and her frustration. The fellow artist Jenny DeWeese and her friend remembered she'd, quote, take up old paintings, tear them up, and rearrange them. They were all very visual. In the back, when you exit, you can see this piece here on the right, and you can actually see the very edges where McCloslin tore old works apart and then glued them back together to create something new. This new creation had the words, "The whole world is watching," glued from newsprint in the upper right-hand corner. This was a not-so-subtle reference to the phrase that thousands of demonstrators yelled outside the Chicago conventions. And so I think in these visible moments of activism, you really see where McCloslin's modernist sensibilities intersect in both art and architecture. McCloslin once said, "To understand the work of any vital contemporary artist, we must look at the inner, not the outer eye." With this vision, we may see that the present-day artist is searching for an order and faith in life, and perhaps expresses as an individual that for which the collective human mind is also searching. Tonight, the Extreme History Project and the Museum of the Rockies have brought you really a two-for-one, in my opinion. It's both a history talk and an art show. And so I will be discussing the life of Helen McCloslin, the inner eye, if you will. Helen McCloslin was one of Bozeman's lesser-known modern artists, and I will be highlighting just really a fraction of her collection. It's about a 600-work collection stored here at the museum, and so I'll be highlighting probably about a dozen pieces. In this presentation, I want to suggest that Helen McCloslin is noteworthy for the way her life both intersected with modern art and modern architecture. Both movements I characterize as rejecting traditional forms to create anew through experimentation. So in essence, McCloslin really became a modern medium through her home, through her artwork, and as you'll see, through her sort of nonconformist lifestyle. So unlike most women of her generation, Helen McCloslin joined a charmed upbringing that allowed her really to push social boundaries. Born in 1895, she grew up in a middle-class household in Providence, Rhode Island. Her mother, Fanny Thompson McCloslin, was a U.S.-born professional singer, a voice coach, and a music teacher. Her father, Dugald McCloslin, was a Scottish immigrant, an oil company manager, and a tennis enthusiast. Family wealth derived from her father's job in the Pennsylvania petroleum industry, as well as her uncle's ownership of a department store. And her grandmother, Maria Thompson, was sort of her primary caregiver growing up, and she would also often impart stories of her departed father, her husband, who was a painter, had a career as a painter, which might have inspired the young girl. In 1913, McCloslin enrolls in Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts, which is one of the quote-unquote Seven Sisters colleges that were founded in the New England area in the mid to late 19th century for educating women. Here is her yearbook photo up here from her junior year. You can see she did an acronym for McClosland going down, which stood for modest, clever, artistic, undemonstrative, Scotch, laconic, athletic, and nonchalant. So you get a little bit of her personality through that. During her academic training, she took everything from Freudian science to the Socratic method. Like it said, she was athletic, so she played on the tennis, the field hockey team, which she's pictured up here. She's the top row, second from left, and the track and field teams. When I was looking through school records, I saw that she set the school record for an event known as the ball throw, which I wish track and field still did. It's kind of a cross between discus and shot put, where you had this huge weighted ball that was on a chain and you'd sort of spin around and then chuck it. But so apparently she set the school record of 163 feet 8 inches, which I haven't verified to this, but I think to this day it still stands. So after 4 years of study, she graduated with honors, earning a bachelor's degree in philosophy and psychology. And for the time period, McClosland really bucked educational trends. By 1918, only 2% of the college-aged population obtained degrees in the United States, and only one-third of those graduates were women. So Mount Holyoke, like other liberal arts institutions dedicated for educating women, they really worked at nurturing female independence. It's unclear whether or not McClosland attended the 1913 International Exhibition of Modern Art in New York City, and this is often credited by historians of bringing modern art from Europe to the United States. Going to school at Mount Holyoke, which is in Massachusetts, she was very close, so she very well could have. But this much is certain about the Armory Show, as it was popularly known. Right around that time, Helen McClosland begins experimenting with abstract painting. In 1920, she joins the Arts Students League, learning techniques from a renowned cast of avant-garde artists such as Yasuo Kiyonoshi, Max Weber, Boardman Robinson, and John Sloan, with mentoring that sort of stressed constant experimentation over traditional methods. McClosland really finds her passion and purpose as a modern artist. The 1920s and 30s really turn out to be pivotal years for her in both personal and professional terms. McClosland moves into a home in Westfield, New Jersey with her mother after the passing of her father, but she maintains an art studio on Union Square in downtown Manhattan, where she would regularly commute to pursue her painting career as an abstract expressionist. New York City's Cosmopolitan Bureau really exposed McClosland to novel feminist ideals, labeled by some historians as quote-unquote the new woman, which really disputed the social and political norms of the times. Remember, if the 1920s, we see the ratification of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. In New York City, you had Margaret Sanger advocating for birth control access to ensure female reproductive control. You had the stereotypical flapper who would muddle gender roles through masculine affectations and dress and behavior. And so in some ways, McClosland embraced this sort of new woman ideal, or she fits that model. For example, she drank, she smoked, she never married in her entire life, she wore a bobbed haircut for a time period, she was very much involved in liberal politics, and she painted nude models to celebrate the female body. To the left up here is one of her earlier sketches, and to the right is one of her later works. I found it interesting going through the collection that nude women make up maybe 24 of the 600 collections, so a sizable portion of her work. And what I really appreciate about them is they really display the sort of diversity of body types and not just the sort of stereotypical pinup model that you see. So as her prestige in art circles really grew, McClosland would journey overseas for creative inspiration. So, for example, she took a tour through her ancestral homeland in Scotland. She did a bicycle trip through France. She visited the Caribbean islands of Dominica and Martinique. And so we really see McClosland's cosmopolitanism come out through her international travels. And here we have a couple of works from her 1930 trip to Reykjavik, which is the coastal capital of Iceland. To the left is a painting with two very abstract fishermen at center that just sort of mere outlines, bringing home sort of the daily catch. And then to the right, we have her interpretation of an Icelandic landscape. So this is kind of her interpretation. And both of these works employ what art historians call cubism, which is using simple sort of geometric shapes to compose the work. And so these paintings that McLaughlin would produce in these from these international excursions often found themselves in exhibits when she came back to New York City. So, for example, the GRD studio showcased a couple of her paintings and really sort of confirmed her elevated status. The New York Evening Post, when they reviewed her work, said, quote, "Miss McLaughlin paints with limpid color and decisive pattern. You feel the crystal clearness in the air in which every object stands out in strange emphasis. It is much the same world of the far north which a noted painter and explorer has depicted for us." End quote. So by the 1930s, McLaughlin had really firmly established herself in the art world. From over 1,000 submissions, the urban critic Lewis Mumford and the American Institute for Graphic Arts chose one of her prints as the 50 Best Prints of the Year for 1931. And this first-class exhibition was exhibited in New York City and then took sort of a tour all around the country. That same decade, McLaughlin traveled to Mexico City, where she was exposed to the art murals of revolutionaries Diego Rivera, José Clemente Orozco, and David Alfaro Cisqueros. A little Mexican history, 1910 is when Mexicans dispose of the dictator Porfirio Díaz, the right-wing dictator, and in 1917 they write a new constitution, which is very much a populist constitution. It's supposed to be for the people. And so we kind of see this carry over to the 1930s with the Lázaro Cárdenas administration, which is very much, people often compare him to like a Franklin Delano Roosevelt figure, but very much trying to make government work for people. And so this trip to Mexico is really crucial for development because in social revolutionary Mexico, McLaughlin really sees this radical combination of both modernist aesthetics and democratic populism. So just as Mexican artists would defend peasants or Indians or other marginalized groups in their artwork, McLaughlin begins experimenting with deploying some of her paintings for social justice causes. So to the image to the left, you see a peasant standing in the foreground, standing in front of a butcher shop. And then on the right-hand side of this piece, you see people with picket signs picketing. So this is, you know, an attempt to really try to capture the voice of the people and the discontent. But after all that international travel and sort of spending a lot of time in New York City, McLaughlin wanted eventually a sort of change from her urban settings. And so in 1932, McLaughlin decides to spend a summer at Jack Clark's X Bar A Dude Ranch, which is located just south of Big Timber, Montana. And really, she was not alone for wanting to escape from the city. By 1935, there were over 350 dude ranches operating in the American West, which not only hosted thousands of dudes, as the male guests were called, but also boarded hundreds of female dudeens. Now, while these guest ranches often portrayed sort of traditional values of sort of a mythologized Western past, they also allowed elite women like McLaughlin to have greater independence than they might experience in their Eastern homes, such as inclusion in often masculinized activities such as trail riding or hunting. So aside from enjoying sort of fewer constraints, McLaughlin really fell in love with the landscape. And so here you see a painting of the Anaconda Smelter, which I think is very interesting because for a lot of Western artists of a previous generation, there was a focus on pastoral landscapes. And so one of the things modernists do is they kind of shift the emphasis from the pastoral to a more industrial environment. So this is her sort of interpretation of that industrial environment in Montana. So from the time of her first visit in 1932 until 1946, McCausland would make these annual trips out to Montana. And I think it's interesting when you compare it with another pupil of the Arts Students League, Georgia O'Keeffe, who was during the same time period, during the 1930s and 40s, was making annual pilgrimages out to New Mexico. So I don't know what it was about sort of the allure of the West, but it was sort of this larger cultural phenomenon. So during World War II, McCausland decides that she's going to buy a small farm on the hinterlands of eastern suburbs in New Jersey, and she's going to raise these red-colored Duroc pigs as her sort of war contribution, right? This is going to be meat for soldiers. Why I bring this up is, A, she did a lot of drawings of pigs. So in addition to a lot of nude female figures, there's a lot of drawings of pigs. And so in the back, you'll see this drawing of two pigs sort of basking. And then you'll also see a wood sculpture that McCausland did. And I think this is significant in that maybe sort of the confidence that built when she's like, well, hey, if I can be an eastern pig farmer, maybe I can be a western cattle rancher. So in 1947, the same year that her mother dies, she actually decides that she's going to purchase and operate the Diamond Lazy H Bar Ranch in Springdale, Montana. In one of her writings back to Mount Holyoke, she says, quote, "I have recently acquired a cattle ranch in Montana and have about 4,000 acres near the mountains and am enjoying it greatly. Also painting when I have the time." But after 3 years of pastoral labor and actually very little time to paint, she actually decides to sell the Springdale Ranch, and she ends up buying a small piece of land on Clark's guest ranch that she'd been staying on annually, and she has a cabin built near the West Fork of the Bow Little River. So although McCausland lived near Big Timber, she actually spent a great deal of her time in Bozeman. And the reason is by mid-20th century, Bozeman had fostered this community of countercultural artists, despite its outward reputation as a conservative town of cowboys and cold warriors. The painters pictured up here, Jenny and Bob DeWeese, were largely responsible for cultivating this liberal group of nonconformers. The DeWeeses arrived in 1949 when Bob accepted a teaching position in the art department at Montana State College. The DeWeeses, who really felt isolated from sort of other abstract expressionists in Montana, really worked to try to forge connections with the avant-garde in the local area. And so as I've talked with Josh and Tina, who I know are in the audience, you know, they went to every art opening they could so that they could try to connect and build sort of a larger community. The other way that they built community was that during the 1950s and 60s, the DeWeeses held regular parties of local artists, musicians, architects, and other like-minded people at Bob's downtown studio, which was sort of located up this derelict set of stairs to a sort of second floor flat on a historic brick building on the 200 block of East Main Street. These social gatherings were remembered as sort of raucous affairs of heavy drinking, intense conversation, and on occasion they would do these impromptu theatrical productions of the Threepenny Opera. So McCausland would join these groups' ranks, which was later branded the Bohemians of Bozeman. And Jenny recalled that she was sort of the last one to leave these studio parties. And so eventually the allure of this art community in Bozeman was really too much to resist. She, you know, McCausland had found herself going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And so eventually she decided, well, I'm going to move over here. So in 1965, McCausland buys a piece of property about 5 miles south of Bozeman, Then it was located on rural delivery route number 3. But today it's about the 6,000 block of South 3rd Road. And really, McLaughlin joins the many Americans who increasingly decide to live on a sort of suburban fringe. She hired architect firm Oswald Berg and Associates to design the new home to fit her modern aesthetic. And likely inspired from her frequent travels to Europe, she wanted something along the lines of the German Bauhaus. And this school of thought tried to unite disciplines like the fine arts, such as painting, with more applied arts, such as architecture. So modernist architects in the United States usually come from two types of backgrounds. Either A, they were European immigrants, like Richard Neutra, who's pictured up here to the left, who saw sort of the utter devastation of both world wars. And so modernism was this sort of way to start anew and rebuild and bring in this sort of fresh perspective without reference to sort of those older forms that might have been destroyed during battles. The Austrian-born Neutra gave a series of public lectures at Montana State College in 1949, and he also published a number of articles in the Arts and Architecture magazine that came to be known as the quote-unquote case study houses. And these experimental designs, some of which were built in California, some of which were never actually implemented, were pretty much on the coffee tables of every practicing architect during the time period. And so they likely offered inspiring sort of message or inspiration to architects in Bozeman, like this person, Ozzie Berg. So like Ozzie Berg, the second group of modern architects in the U.S. usually had some sort of background in the military during World War II. And this military experience really taught them rational design, which stretched sort of function over form, right? War is all about efficiency, and so it really imparted that to Berg. And it also imparted them or exposed them to new building materials like steel, glass, reinforced concrete that then could be implemented into architecture and create, you know, with steel you can create very weightless spaces by having steel beams support roof lines, that sort of thing. McLaughlin likely came to know Berg through her group of friends. After serving as a naval engineer during World War II, Berg actually moved back to Bozeman, where he had lived as a teenager, to start his own architectural firm. Berg joined Montana State College as a visiting professor from 1952 to 1954, and it's during this time that he probably met Bob DeWeese and his artist cohort, including McLaughlin. Berg really cemented his reputation for modernist flair after designing a couple buildings. The first one in 1955, he designed what was the Hope Lutheran Church. And as you can see in the picture here, we have this large glass curtain backdrop for the cross. And it was a very inexpensive structure to build. And then in 1956, with Fred Wilson, he designs the MSC Athletics Complex. Today we know it as Brick Breeden Fieldhouse, which was the largest timber dome structure for the time period. Now, I know it's probably hard to think about today, but initially, some Bozeman residents really questioned Berg's work. They really did. They said, so you're really going to make an arena that's going to have a capacity that's the entire population of Bozeman? Really? Or one of the jokes that they would often say is, you've heard of Frank Lloyd Wright? Well, this is Frank Lloyd wrong. And so McLaughlin and these other local artists were significant in that they were provided the early patronage for a lot of these modern architects. So modern architecture might not have taken hold in Bozeman when it did if it weren't for these modern artists who were much quicker to embrace their interpretation of architecture than other residents. So in 1966, Ozzie Berg tries to match her ideal by making a design in what's known as the contemporary style, which was popular for those decades. And the plans entailed a single level floor plan with two entrances, One that came into kind of an open concept living, dining, kitchen area, and then two bedrooms and two bathrooms. And then the other entry was sort of a carport entry where you come in here, and that would lead to her gallery and studio. As far as modernist features, I want to point out on the gable ends of the house, you have these glass curtain walls, very similar to the style that we saw in the Hope Lutheran Church. Jenny DeWeese remembered that it was just spectacular because you could have a view of the mountains pretty much every direction. Remember, she has no neighbors at the time. So, you know, you could see the Bridgers to the north, the Tobacco Roots to the west, and the Gallatin Range to the south. Also, you had these glue-laminated timber beams, which extended past the roofline and had these sort of funky angular end cuts at the end. And so these are all sort of elements that give it a sort of modern look. So that same year, in 1966, McLaughlin moves into her newly constructed home in Bozeman, and her friend Jenny DeWeese that said she decorated just like she would a painting, just the right shape and color to augment the whole. Here, McLaughlin threw numerous parties, again, to kind of foster that sort of non-conforming community, where she, as Jenny remembered, she would pick out particular food for particular people, and then she would hold these like large ping-pong tournaments where she, as Jenny says, she would show kindness to novices and devastation to pretenders. And I guess later, after she would like whoop someone's butt, she would then reveal that she had been this former tennis champion back in New Jersey. Just drop that. At this new home, McLaughlin really continued to her involvement in politics and art. For example, she hosted a local chapter meetings of the League of Women Voters at her new house to encourage female participation in public affairs. She also campaigned for local candidates on the Democratic ticket. And Jenny just remembered that, quote, she possessed an untiring support for humanitarian causes and a particular concern for women. So for creating her artwork, she had this new glass-lined studio. Again, it had this sort of glass curtain walls. And you can see this is her drawing of it, and here's the glass curtain wall. And there's a view of the Bridgers out the window. Here's a view of it today. And it might be because neighbors, but they got rid of the glass curtain wall, which kind of bums me out. But later in her life, McLaughlin really wanted to use her artwork to critique the modern warfare state. And she received that opportunity on May 4th, 1970, when Ohio National Guardsmen opened fire on college students at Kent State University, who had been marching against the United States' expansion of the Vietnam War into Cambodia. 67 rounds over 13 seconds killed 4 protesters and wounded 9 others. In response, McLaughlin went to her studio room of the Bozeman home to recreate these intense scenes on canvas. Painted against a dark palette, human figures lie stretched on the ground, hands clutching chests, maybe breathing their last breath. So just as her brush strokes blended somber colors together, the Kent State paintings really represent McLaughlin's final blending of modern art, modern architecture, and social activism, all of which rejected a past and hoped for a better future. A few months after doing the Kent State paintings, McLaughlin would pass away. So why is Helen McLaughlin's life matter? Why is she significant to Bozeman history and to Montana history? Well, I can think of a couple reasons. The first is stories like Helen McLaughlin really reframe how we think about Western history, right? Usually when we think about Western history, it's usually glued to the 19th century, and figures like this, right, Charlie Russell, Frederick Remington, and their sort of work, again, sort of a romanticized Western artwork, very much focused on sort of cowboys and Indians, that sort of thing. But remembering Helen McLaughlin's story, I think, really brings us out of the 19th century and into the 20th century to other amazing Western artists, people, not only McLaughlin, but women like Jenny DeWeese, women like, so Jenny DeWeese, Jesse Wilbur, and Frances Senska, just to name a few. And so I think Helen McLaughlin is significant in that it helps us maybe reopen the pantheon of Western artists and think about not only including 19th century men, but also these wonderful 20th century women. The second reason I think Helen McCausland's story is worth remembering is that the story it tells for modern architecture in Bozeman. So in 1953, the local modern architect Hugo Eck, who was husband of the famed politician Dorothy Eck, who helped write the 1972 Montana Constitution, Hugo Eck designed a house on Sourdough Road for Francis Senska and Jesse Wilbur in the American style, which was sort of a more naturalistic interpretation of what was known as the international style. So if you've seen anything, any houses that were designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, you'll kind of notice similar patterns. So like the very flat roof, the series of narrow windows, giving it a very modern look. But also you have sort of the earthen tones and the wooden board and batten siding, giving it a more sort of organic feel. And I think it makes perfect sense when you think of someone like Frances Senska, right? She's this modern artist. She's a potter. But she also has this sort of strong environmental ethic that was in many ways imparted in her when she spent her childhood with her missionary parents in Cameroon. She would often reuse materials when composing art. She often made her own clothes. And so her house is sort of, I see as sort of a combination of those values of both modernism and sort of environmentalism. In 1964, another modern architect, Jim Goh, who was a architecture professor at Montana State College, designed a house for Jenny and Bob DeWeese and their five children in Cottonwood Canyon. I think Tina described it as an experiment in economy, because it was something like they wanted a home with, I think it was five or six rooms for $15,000. In many ways, that was the beauty about modern architecture, is it used less expensive building materials, and so they were able to do that. And so Jim Goh designed what was known as, this is called the raised ranch style. So if you see a ranch house, but sort of stacked, sort of. And it has sort of the low-pitched roof line. It has two amazing picture windows right here, which are, you know, perfect for letting in all that beautiful sun. And so I think with crazy growth that Bozeman is experiencing right now, houses from this era are really under threat from ongoing development. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, the McCausland home or the Senska and Wilbur home or the DeWeese home are going to be knocked down. I'm not saying that. But what I am saying is that houses that they're representative of, things like ranch houses or contemporary style, are. And so I think we need a historic preservation agenda that really identifies these sort of less well appreciated homes, because they really are amazing architectural resources and really have amazing stories that go with them.